software. Software's been terrible today.
Really? What did software do to you today?
So I was using Nuke earlier, which is probably all you need to know.
This is a good start to any story, really.
I don't know if this is just a Nuke Studio thing or if this is in regular Nuke too, but it did this thing where the viewer stopped updating. I don't know if you've ever had that, where no matter what you click, like the viewer doesn't change.
Yeah, that's what I call restart Nuke time.
Yeah, and I was a little lazy, so I didn't want to. So I was like poking around trying to get it to do things. And then like it did a thing where like it lagged, or it seemed like it lagged, and then it just like caught up with a bunch of operations because like I adjusted a slider on the grain node, which is what I was trying to do. And then all of a sudden it said like no node selected. I'm like, what operation are you trying to do right now? So I quit and I restarted the app. And
so you did the thing that I said, but you didn't want to do it before because you were too busy.
Well, I was trying to get it to come back without restarting the app, but it clearly was not having any of that. And as soon as I saw the no node selected thing, I'm like, all right, clearly there's something very peculiar going on here. So, but once I restarted it and then I dialed my grain back in, I'm like, cool, it looks great. And then I played it. And all of the manual adjustments I made to the tracker that was not perfect were gone. So my tracker is like wonky now, and my corner pinned insert is all screwy. So I have to redo all of that now.
Mm.
And I don't know why it decided to throw out the animation data from a node that wasn't even open when I was adjusting my grain, but that's what it did.
Well, that's why you save and version up frequently.
Yeah, I went back to the previous version and it had gotten screwed up in there too. So,
have you considered using a planar tracker?
Yeah, I used a planar tracker to stabilize a thing. I didn't do the planar tracker for the
solve
for the insert and the little thing because. I didn't take out the lens distortion, so it didn't really work that well. I tried it; it didn't look great, but. My 4-point track corner pin looked perfect until it decided to throw out that data and start over.
Mm.
What are you gonna do?
Keep on keeping on.
Mm. I guess Williams is awake. He saw the tweet and decided to text me some of his creepy Swillmoji faces.
I am not a fan of those stickers.
Have you seen all of them?
I've seen whatever he's screenshotted, did and posted to Twitter. He has offered to get my phone number so that he can send me more.
Well, he has some animated ones too. One where it like his face like slides up out of a false horizon, so it's making a creepy face, but it like pops up in an animated fashion and stares at you.
Well, do you know what I don't need to see?
He's sending them all to me right now. Mm. Oh, thanks, buddy.
It's one way to get the word out about your app.
He's listening, apparently. He says hi, Joe.
Well, that's nice. We also have some sticker news as well.
Yeah.
Because
Wait, is that out?
Not yet.
Oh.
I meant your other thing.
Oh, that. disregard. Me and Ryan made a stupid sticker pack.
Yeah, because what was it? One time you, Matt Alexander, and Ryan were all talking about birds on furniture, and then that somehow led to a sticker pack where all of a sudden I got some picture of furniture with a bird on top of it in my messages. So that was a totes adorbs. And I was invited to the beta on that, which was a delightful experience, really.
I think you used it once, right?
I didn't really know that you guys had it in you to do that, but
it's really not very difficult. It took about, I think, probably 4 hours of combined work to do the whole thing.
Yeah, because I think it's mostly just like put stuff in a folder for the sticker things, right?
Yeah, and then just fill out all of the information on Test Flight and then the App Store thingamabob to categories and descriptions and what have you, but
yeah, it probably took longer to invite me on Test Flight than it did to
yeah, Test Flight's terrible, by the way. It doesn't report people who are actually have downloaded the app, but in an attempt to sum up what happened with that, occasionally you've been witness to it. Occasionally Matt Alexander pops into our little Slack there and says some peculiar things because he is occasionally a peculiar man. And we just often run with the conversation and see where it ends up and just, you know, blow off some steam being dumb in the Slack. And he decided that an interesting unit of measure would be animals, particularly birds, on top of furniture. I think it came about, we were describing the height of Nicolas Cage, and he said something about an eagle on a hat rack in the middle of the road, and people not being able to tell the difference between that and Nicolas Cage from a distance. And then we started just kicking around birds on furniture in various permutations and using them to describe the relative heights of things.
My one criticism of that is that you do not have an image of the middle of the road.
No, well,
so you cannot recreate the scenario that initially started this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't matter necessarily where you put the furniture and the bird. I mean, technically, the iMessage chat is the road in which we are placing the furniture with the bird on top.
It's a metaphor.
It's a metaphor. It's a, you know, it's not perfect. It's we don't do skeuomorphism anymore. That was way all the way back in iOS 6. Now our road is a white iMessage chat with blue and potentially green text bubbles. Well, I guess not green because then those people wouldn't be able to see them.
You took the road less.
Skeuomorphized. The roadless skeuomorphized. Yeah.
The roadless literal.
So, yeah, the sticker pack contains roughly an even number amount of birds and furnitures.
I don't believe that it is the...
That's not the proper plural of furniture?
No.
So, yeah, you can place a bird on top of a furniture item. Also, celebrities, because celebrities are very important.
You could just say... furniture. that would include both of those. You don't need to say furnitures or furniture item. You can just say furniture.
I'm attempting to maintain the style guide that we did not come up with.
Oh my god, there was a style guide?
No, there was no style guide whatsoever. There are very few rules associated with this, but the sticker pack is live. It's called Birds on Furniture, if you haven't
what a clever name.
Yeah. There's also a Twitter account that if you're looking for advice on how to properly represent the things that you are trying to compare in height, the Birds on Furniture Twitter account is a good example for you to figure out, to learn how this whole thing came about and how we're using it publicly.
If the name Birds on Furniture did not give you enough information.
No, apparently it didn't give enough information to some people. Some people still don't get it, or... you know, they don't find the humor in it, perhaps, is probably a better description, so.
Well, I mean, it is an inside joke turned into a sticker pack, but...
Hey, we're not the only ones to do that. Come on. Like, no. All of these apps, there are so many. A lot of them are Matt Alexander-based and Bionic-based and Bonanza-based, and...
Wait, are there other Matt Alexander-based stickers? That I'm not aware
stickers,
of,
but I mean there are many other apps. That, you know, there were the sounds. There's the keyboards.
Well,
there's the Matt and Mike Snake app.
John Voorhees, who did the app for Bionic and the app for what was the other thing? I can't remember. He's not updating them for the new thing, so they might be removed from the store now that they're removing old things.
What?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that sad?
For
listeners
sad.
Who are not aware, there was a podcast called Bionic, and it is
similar levels of Matt Alexander nonsense that spawned the Birds on Furniture metaphor.
Yes, unhinged is maybe a way to describe it, but
it's free form. It's very loose and casual and fun.
Yeah. And the
stream of consciousness.
The continuation of that is of course on the Relay network. So go over to Relay FM for Bonanza and all of your Matt Alexander needs, I suppose.
Everyone needs a little bit of Matt Alexander, and now you can send his face as a sticker. And it's great. If you place it in the right place, it kind of pushes the text bubble out of the way and makes it look like the text bubble is coming out of his mouth. And that can be very effective in instances.
That's weird. There is another sticker, as you previously alluded to. The other thing might be coming out soon. So keep an eye out for it.
But yeah, there are potentially more branded sticker packs with some relation to this podcast. Ooh, William's in the chat. Just says, breaking news. The Incomparable sticker pack was just released.
Oh. that's what I get for not being current on my my Slacks. But
that's what you get for watching a 2.5 hour movie written going straight into a podcast. So, yeah, it looks
like
it's such a
long
sticker pack.
Such a long movie. But so the Incomparable sticker pack, which we'll have in the show notes, also includes our show. Unfortunately for them, we exist on the network. Now
it includes our wonderful t-shirt design, as well as the beautiful, iconic Shame Burrito graphic created by Forgotten Tell, Frank Towers.
Mm-hmm. And that's not even it. Neither of those are his real name.
Well, I don't know his real name. I think you do, but you're not going to tell.
No. That gets a spy killed. Now, the thing that's important to know about the sticker pack is that if you send the Defocus shirt logo to anyone, that's the one with the triangles, if you're not aware, if you send that to anyone, make sure you send it with lasers in iOS.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, because it is amazing.
If you didn't realize, you can send stickers with lasers, which I first discovered by sending Matt Alexander's face with lasers.
Well, that sounds like a good combo.
It is. You've got a very tired, hungover-looking British American man.
That sounds like a judgment, really.
No, he was very tired and hungover in that photo. Oh. He admits it readily. And you can add some laser backgrounds to it.
Oh, well, I mean, is there anything lasers don't improve?
No, they do pretty great on eyesight.
That was your list.
No. Sorry, just sending me our logo, sent with shooting star. But all I see is an iMessage on my computer because my phone is on do not disturb, of course.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, thank you, Williams, for being as disruptive as possible. Even though you gave us the breaking news about the sticker pack.
Yep.
All the great stickers.
So we got Scott Williams' face. We have a sticker pack that is Birds on Furniture. And mm-hmm. we have a sticker pack that says Defocused and Shame Burrito. So I think we are good on sticker packs that are relevant to the discourse of this podcast. Please send all of them with lasers. And I would like to go on from here to branch out, to segue with the lasers. We can segue into the beginning of Aliens, which has... Mm. A machine that descends from the ceiling and shoots lasers to see if anything is something inside of a space. It doesn't seem to do anything really, but there is a machine with a laser thing that goes through fog at the start of Aliens.
It's a pretty good looking fog too.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about atmosphere really. That's something that Ridley Scott taught us in the first film, Alien. Which was not an insignificant number of years prior to the release of this. This is 86, and the original Alien was 1979. So there's 7 years already that have elapsed between that and the sequel.
It's rather surprising, don't you think?
Yeah, I never really think about it in those terms. I suppose Sigourney Weaver doesn't seem like she has aged a tremendous amount between the two films.
Well, I mean, she is, what, 57 years older?
Well, I mean, I meant in the...
I know.
Yeah, in
she,
the
she
real
does,
world.
She doesn't age.
No. She is flawless, a flawless human being, Sigourney Weaver. And we start off with a worse title than the previous, so not as iconic.
You know, like the sort of foggy CRT display thing that just fades in weird?
No, it is definitely not as iconic as the title sequence for Alien. And if you watch the two back to back, you'll be like, oh yeah, yeah, this one didn't make it. Because this one, it's got the nice little glowing aperture thing that comes out from the eye in Alien, like almost like a cat's eye expanding across the screen. Unfortunately, the rest of it kind of looks like poop. So I don't love the title. As opposed to Alien, where you just see those black bars slowly start to assemble into Alien over time. And it's much more graphic and interesting, in my opinion. Fortunately, this title sequence is shorter, so I suppose there's a positive note. And we are introduced to Blue Space, sort of nebula gaseous thing and the escape pod from the previous film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Blue space. It's that's an interesting matte painting. Yeah, the it's interesting that it attempts to pick up, like, I've seen this movie a bunch of times, like most of it, I should say, a bunch of times. I don't know that I've seen the beginning of it maybe more than once, and I did not remember a lot of this stuff. I mean, I know that it picks up where it left off with her sort of asleep, and then, you know, they break in and wake her up out of her little frozen coma, and then there's Paul Reiser with his sweet-ass future jacket thing with the popped collar. I didn't realize it was supposed to be 57, like, she was asleep for 57 years. I totally forgot all about the, her daughter was 66 and then died. And then, you know, that whole thing kind of ties back in with Newt and the emotional connection, which I guess makes a little bit more sense. I guess you have to correct me. Is all of that in the, special edition or the regular edition? I can't remember what you said, the difference was between the regular and special editions.
Oh, I don't know. Short answer for everyone who's listening, if you're curious as to what we actually watched for this, for the original Alien movie last year in October, we discussed the theatrical release, because I feel like the director's release doesn't really add a tremendous amount, and it is also peculiar in light of the sequels that came afterwards, because they're changes that Ridley Scott made in, what, 2003 or 2004? So they're not really incorporating any of the things that actually wound up happening later. So there's the scenes of the crew being cocooned and metamorphized into alien creatures of some sort, which was an idea that Ridley originally had but was abandoned because it was cut from the film. So it is strange to go back and see that now, which is why I reject it, because it doesn't mesh well with anything for me. But for Aliens, I've only ever seen it on television and DVD and VHS before that, and those versions of it are all basically based on changes that James Cameron made in 1992 to extend it back to the length of the film that he wanted to have. He had been told by Fox to shave off like 15 minutes of the film, and that mainly included the robot sentries, scenes with the colonists, and the scene about Sigourney Weaver's daughter being dead, which happened in that fake park, which we'll get to. But those parts had been shaved out of the theatrical release.
Yeah, and I kind of liked that little addition of the daughter thing, and I didn't mind the colonist stuff. It's just like I had definitely not seen a lot of that stuff ever, if more than once at most. But like, you know, the her little inquiry where they suspend her license and stuff, and the guy at the head of the table is all like, "Well, what are you talking about? You're clearly a crazy person, because we got people living there." And she starts freaking out, like, "How many people are living there and why? It's a terrible idea. You should get them out of there." And it's interesting that the derelict ship is on the other side of the planet, or just at least far enough away that they hadn't been able to make their way over to the colony that's been there for 20 years.
Yeah, well, supposedly they didn't know the exact coordinates or whatever it was. And because of Ridley being thought out and captured by that deep salvage team back at Gateway Station, she has her inquest and she divulges the information she has, which includes the location of where they sat down. And that leads, unfortunately, a team of people, a small family, over to go check it out. None of this seems like a good idea, but of course, it is all signed by Burke. We find that out much later in the film, but I've never seen this knowing that Burke was a good guy, so it never surprised me.
Yeah, I tried to watch it with fresh eyes and go like, oh, look, Paul Reiser's trying to do like a nice guy thing in the beginning here, and it's going to turn out that that's not the case, but who could be mad at Paul Reiser? He's Paul Reiser.
No, Paul Reiser is evil to the core. And this is not like mess up your Ferrari or Lamborghini, Paul Reiser. This is much worse than that. I know we've recently discussed the Beverly Hills Cop movies, including Beverly Hills Cop 2, directed by Ridley Scott, his brother, Tony Scott, who also did Top Gun, which we talked about last week. And so there are all of these connections meshing in with the 1980s. So
the Scots were, the Scots did some good stuff in the 80s, didn't they?
Yeah, they had a good eye for talent. And now, of course, this film is by James Cameron, not by Ridley Scott.
And why did, I don't want to read this Wikipedia article. Do you have any insight into why Cameron picked this up instead of Ridley?
Nope. I didn't read it either. Now, anyone who is intimately familiar with the details of this movie is going to be upset at us for not knowing that, but whatever. All I know is that they had apparently promised a sequel, but there was a change in leadership with Fox, and then it didn't happen, and then it eventually materialized, mostly because of what James Cameron had done for The Terminator, which was a small-budget action thing with a lot of intricate effects work. You might have heard of it.
Yeah, I have. I mean, it makes sense. James Cameron's a good selection for this. He's good at sequels as well, as he's proven. He's also proven that he's a big fan of human beings and large mechanized robot-type things fighting larger animals, something he's done a couple times. But he does pretty well in this movie.
Yeah. Cameron has an effects background. Because that's how he got started. There was a Battle Beyond the Stars, where he was the visual effects guy for that. I want to say supervisor, but he also, I think, basically did everything too, or most of it. And that was a movie which featured a film score by James Horner, who also does the film score for Aliens here. Coincidence, but James Horner. Was so mad at James Cameron for how he chopped up and messed with his score to squeeze it into the film in editing. And also, apparently, James Cameron had rearranged some things and pulled from different sources. I don't know all of the full details. I believe that he pulled from other alternative takes from, I think, some music cue from Goldsmith's previous score, if I'm not mistaken. It's been a long time since I've read those details, so I might be foggy on that. But basically, Horner was upset that all of his stuff had been futzed with, and so he didn't work with Cameron again until Titanic, and that was many, many, many years later.
So, I hear that was a good movie, and a lot of people enjoyed that one as well.
Yeah, I've heard.
I think it did all right.
Yeah, I saw Celine Dion in Vegas sing the thing. There was a fountain of water that came down from the ceiling, and she was elevated on a platform. I'm not joking. This happened. But anyway.
Do you find that the score works, or do you think it suffers from Cameron's futzing?
Honestly, before I knew that Cameron had messed around with it, I didn't even think once about it not working. Like, I thought the score worked fine for me. The one notable aspect of that is that I also seen Star Trek III: The Search for Spock, where there's a Klingon action theme, which is mostly what you hear during the action cues in this. James Horner is sort of infamous for borrowing things from himself. And so there are some similarities in that regard. Also, he borrows things from like Gustav Mahler or whatever. But so he's a bit of a reuse guy. But I enjoy what he does. Like Ripley's Rescue and Bishop's Countdown, both great film cues. You can pull up the soundtrack and listen to either of those while you're driving through traffic in LA, and they really get you going. They're nice. I like them.
Yeah. Another one of the things that's tough to watch this movie with trying to watch it again with fresh eyes, also with the, you know, the Paul Reiser problem, is the suspense, especially when they first get aboard the colony there and start walking around trying to figure out what's going on, because, you know, they show up all cocky and ready to fight and stuff, and they quickly get reset and have their butts handed to them. But it's interesting trying to watch it with imagining seeing it for the first time, like in a theater, even back in 86. And this movie would have been utterly terrifying is the only thing I can think of, because it's suspenseful and it's awesome. And especially in 86, just with the, you know, the futuristic stuff, and it's still super cool and gritty looking these days, I think. But this must have been fun to see in theaters is all I know.
Yeah. I mean, the production design is top notch. It is, instead of being Ron Cobb and Geiger like it was on the first film, it's primarily, I believe, Sid Mead doing all of the stuff for the Colonial Marines and the colonist base. That's all stuff he tackled. And there are Geiger designs, but there's also Stan Winston's influence here. And one thing I will note is that I don't like the sort of Klingon forehead that he gave the aliens. I don't know if you noticed, but in the original film and then several of the sequels, the aliens all have this sort of elongated, flat dome head that's usually partially translucent to some other stuff underneath. And in this particular outing, there is this bumpy, ridgy stuff that kind of looks like the aspects of the wall that you see. And that is, I am led to believe, a decision by Stan Winston when he was doing the design of them. So they're slightly different from the original, and they're also slightly different from things you see afterwards, which I would say probably harken more back to the original design by Geiger.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they stepped it up clearly, because I think, as we talked about in the last one, it was a very small movie, mostly built around tension and suspense, and this one they clearly had a bigger budget and did some more interesting things, and they had more aliens to work with, so they wanted to spruce them up a little bit. But I think they were all sufficiently terrifying, especially because they didn't all specifically just look like a dude in a suit.
Well, they also kind of looked like a dude in a suit suspended on wires in a couple of these shots. So
a couple of them, like when they're in the air vents and stuff, are a little weird. But
yeah, well, I mean, the ones in the air vents, some of those shots are filmed looking up at guys in suits on wires climbing down, but they're shot as if they are ground level, moving along on an even surface to the ground. You can tell because when they shoot them up and the stuff falls off of them and they explode and whatever, all of it flies at camera way too fast. And that's because they're hanging upside down.
It's better than the end of Alien, where they had dude in a suit hanging by the wire outside the airlock.
Yeah. And then they blast him with the water that's backlit by the lights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your fuel. This is an interesting film. The production design is great. I think the design, especially of the military aspects of this, is wonderful, with the exception of the dropship, which I feel is cartoonish.
is that just because of the animation of it, or?
No, not just because of how they chose to do the execution, but literally it is this thing that has these wings that unfold and have, like, what is it, 12 missiles on each wing? Like, it looks patently absurd. But, you know, it's there to reinforce our view of the Marines at the start of the film, that they're gung-ho and cocksure, and they feel like they know what they're doing, but they don't really know what they're getting into, that this is your sort of testosterone-filled, will crush everything Marines, and that it is the audience watching that the entire time going, nope, you guys are all underestimating this situation. But we keep seeing it. And we see it in the design of things. We see the stainless steel interiors of their ships. We see the design of the Sulaco, which basically looks like a gun floating in space. We see the armored personnel carrier, the APC, which is a remote controlled car. And we see
the car thing, where is the did you ever be go on the ride, the Aliens ride? Is that like Universal Studios or was that Disneyland? I can't remember.
I don't know of an Aliens ride. I know there was like an Aliens vignette inside of a ride that was inside of the MGM Studios version of I can't even remember what their name of the ride is. I don't think it exists anymore. But basically, the MGM Studios in Orlando, Florida, had a replica of what used to be called Grauman's Chinese Theater from Hollywood. And inside of that, there was a ride where you sort of just sat in a little car that moved through, and there was an animatronic Ripley, and the ceiling caved down, and there was an alien thing and stuff.
I should rephrase. It's not necessarily a ride, but it's one of those like small movie theaters where you sit in a chair that moves up and down and left and right and vibrates like you're actually in the car.
That's a simulator.
Sure.
It's not a ride.
It's a ride in as much as you're being tossed around by a chair.
You don't go anywhere, though.
I know, but it's a very violent moving chair.
Okay. It doesn't mean it's a ride.
You're ostensibly in the car. I think that there were some 3D goggles associated with it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, I have no knowledge of this.
That's what I remember about the car.
Okay. And you don't remember which theme park attraction this was?
I feel like it was a Universal Studios thing, but I could not tell you. It was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was fun. Driving the car around, breaking through walls and stuff, people shouting right into the camera, making it look like they're talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
One of those things.
Yeah.
It's like the Back to the Future one. They have a Disneyland in Anaheim there.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, I think they took them out, though.
Right. It's not Back to the Future anymore. It's a Star Wars one, isn't it?
No. Because Back to the Future was in Universal Studios.
Oh, that's right. What am I thinking of at Disneyland then? Just something similar with Star Wars?
There's Star Tours at Disneyland and MGM Studios, but it's different. But anyway, I feel like we have digressed a great deal.
Do you think people haven't seen this movie?
I know of a few people that have talked to on Twitter who haven't seen this movie, and it always surprises me. I'm taken aback because sometimes there are people who, you know, I would say support strong women in things in real life and feel like women should be protagonists in things. And I'm just like, why have you not seen Aliens? Because Sigourney Weaver is basically the driving force of this film, and she does everything in the world, and she is a superhuman. Like, that is a reason to watch. Aliens is this is one of the rare roles where you see a female lead like crush it. So yeah. It is worth watching just for that alone.
Yeah, she's not just like an awesome female lead in this. Like, she is just like one of the baddest characters in 80s action movies, period, in this movie.
Yeah, she in the first film, she is thinking, but she's running scared. Much in the same way that women inside of other horror films are usually thinking but running scared, and they make it out alive from whatever thing they were running away from. In this film, she has to deal with the thing that she had experienced previously. She has to confront these fears, and she's forced into that fact by Burke, who gives her that plastic business card.
It's a pretty sweet business card,
which she inserts into a special slot in a machine that dials him up on video phone.
It's convenient, right? You just put your business card in the thing, and you don't need to give people your phone number. It just automatically calls them.
It doesn't really seem like a good idea, but it seems like a bit of a unitasker. But they that gets us into this realm of her confronting her fears. She goes back without the cat. She's got to deal with these Marines and let them know that they don't know poop from poop. And
I think the most difficult to believe part of this movie is the fact that she would ever go back in any capacity at all.
No, I buy that she would go back for the reasons that Burke manipulates her at the beginning, where he says, oh, you know, there's no shame in doing what you're doing, being a load lifter in a dock, whatever. Like, he lays into her pretty hard to try to get her to go on this journey. He tries to basically, like, tear her up into little tiny pieces so that she will agree. And she does. And so I can give her a pass on that for being manipulated. And then when she gets there, I don't know why she goes down on the drop ship. I'm like, maybe just stay on the ship. But she agrees to go down the drop ship. They go down the planet's surface, and they go through all of the stuff. Now, the part that might stretch the imagination, if you're really focused on where she was in the previous films, is the part where she becomes an action hero at the very, very end in the third act. She's a bit of a hero in the second act as well, but in the third act, full hero. She is going the extra mile there.
Yeah, she takes over sort of the leadership role in planning, you know, what they should do and how they should block stuff up strategically so they don't die, and then how they could potentially get out of there. But really what they're trying to do is, you know, she lost her daughter in the beginning of this movie, which you either may or may not have seen, depending on which version of the movie you saw. But she has this new adoptive daughter in Newt / Rebecca, who lost her family and has now become her surrogate daughter because, you know, her daughter was 10 when she left during the first movie. And she gets captured by the aliens, and they're gonna put facehuggers on her. So she straps up a machine gun and a flamethrower and goes after her in just like the most like gnarly action movie style ever, with like the slow pushing in cameras and the strapping on the gun and putting in the magazines, and just like it's just like full-blown like Rambo montage basically, but in the future with aliens.
Yeah, I believe that was probably part of James Cameron's pitch. And you know, she let's go back to the beginning of the film. She has her nightmare from after she's rescued, and she's brought back inside of a Gateway station. She doesn't know where it is. She doesn't recognize the place. It's the old wake up from a dream trope, where she has a chest burster, which she's deathly afraid of. It goes out of her chest in slow motion. They're screaming and everything, and then she wakes up.
It's very 80s. But yeah. But that also kind of confused me, because that scene starts with Paul Reiser giving her the you've been asleep for 57 years or whatever thing. So I'm like, oh, that was a dream. Wait, so was she actually asleep for 57 years, or do we have to...
No. See, I think that was actually something that had happened, but now she's remembering it in a dream. And then the end of the dream is the bursting out of the chest.
It was a little confusing, though.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I like it. It's dreamlike, but, you know, depends on your feelings about people having dreams and waking up from them. But, so, she has her inquest, and she goes and she sits in the fake park with the rear projection trees, and he comes over and he reluctantly shows her a very digital printout of her dead daughter, who died 2 years before. And who had lived
dot matrix printer paper too, by the way.
It is amazing piece of paper, really, when you get down to it. And that is definitely no iPhone 7 photography there, plus or otherwise. But so they look over that, and then this of course shakes Ripley, because she had promised that her daughter that she would be back for her 11th birthday, and that she never made it back. I've never been able to figure out exactly how fast ships in the Aliens franchise universe travel, so I have no idea how many years that means she was out doing things in the first one, but whatever.
Well, they kind of tried to do some of that stuff in Prometheus with, you know, like they were asleep for 2 years or whatever just to get out to the planet, but they did the same thing in this one, which they did in Prometheus, which I think is just like they should have not written the lines, because it's really annoying. You know, they wake up, you know, however long it took them to get wherever they were going, presumably weeks, months, potentially years, and they go, sorry, we didn't have time to brief you before we left. It's like, really? You went on a 2-year cryo sleep mission and you didn't have time to like have a 15-minute meeting before you left? That's a little, I don't know about that.
Yeah, well, the other problem with this is apparently they lost contact with the colonists, and that set them off on this mission. And they didn't exactly leave right away, because Ripley had to think about it at least long enough to have one nightmare and and call. So some time has elapsed, but it is not a tremendous amount of time. I don't know if we ever got an exact figure on the time. All I know is that Ripley says Newt had lasted longer than 17 days there by herself, but it doesn't seem like that was supposed to be years. It seems like that wasn't that long that they were out there, maybe like a month or something.
Yeah, I thought there was some mention to how long Newt had been there, like a couple of weeks by herself.
She just had some malnutrition.
Right. But yeah, there was no mention to how long the trip took to get from wherever they were to the planet.
Yeah, and there were still colonists who were not completely dead and who were still being impregnated by things. So
maybe it's because the big ship flies faster than her little escape pod from the first movie.
Well, it could be because like apparently her escape pod had drifted. That part doesn't really matter. But just like the rest of the time in Alien and the sequels, I have no idea how fast they're supposed to be traveling. It's fine, I guess. It's not really like a point of anything, but it does seem interesting that they put people to sleep for however long that duration is. I mean, maybe there's something with the G-forces involved that it's better if they're asleep or something, but whatever.
Well, you know, they don't age when they're in cryosleep, so that's good. It's like you go to sleep for 10 minutes, and then you wake up, and it's 2 years later, and you're at your place.
Yeah, except it's not 2 years later. It's just, like, a couple weeks or something.
Well, still, like, if you had the option to, like, pace back and forth on a spaceship for a couple of weeks or just take a nap, and then you feel like you just woke up 15 minutes later.
Yeah, but they got to do all the prep and stuff. And sure. Gorman wakes them up with a very small amount of time to do the prep because they all groan about it. So, yeah. Mm.
At least they got time for, you know, food and doing that hand knife thing with Bishop and Paxton.
Yeah. Well, I suppose she didn't like the cornbread either. So the thing about that scene, the knife scene is pretty infamous. They do it with the sped up camera, et cetera, and the hands and stuff. And then, Bishop goes and he sits down and he accidentally nicked himself and there's a little bit of milky fluid, and it's not the kind of milky fluid you'd normally associate with a human being. It is from an android. So he is spotted by Ripley and she is upset because, as anyone who is familiar with the first film would know, there was an android and he did some bad stuff and he was full of milky fluid. And so she has an immediate averse reaction to this. And of course, Burke forgot to mention that there is an android on the ship. And this android is played by Lance Henriksen, and he says, oh yeah, the A2s are always a little bit twitchy when they discuss the model that was on board Ripley's original mission. And he explains that he cannot allow humans to come to harm, very similar to Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, very unlike Ash, but it does seem like Ripley might not trust him. And
no, very very clearly not. And I like what this movie in particular, especially in comparison to other action movies, does with the characters in terms of like who you think you should trust and who's going to end up a hero and who's going to end up kind of, you know, freaking out along the way. You know, it's pretty clearly that Ripley is going to be our main character and she's going to be solid throughout the movie. But, you know, and then you see things like Hudson, Bill Paxton, he's very, you know, bragging about all the things he's going to kill with all of his weapons and stuff. And you can kind of tell he's going to freak out later, but he does at least step up and do well. Vasquez is also very sort of like acting like a hard ass in the beginning there, but she actually, you know, stands up and does her job better than everyone else. And it's interesting because you're waiting for Bishop to do something stupid, to stab her in the back, and they kind of like, you know, throw you for a curveball there at the end where you think he did but he didn't. And then, you know, just watching how the Marines, some do their jobs, some do them better than others, and I think they do a great job of putting enough confusion and different character types in here to sort of keep you on your toes and wonder who's going to do what and when and how is it going to turn out, because you never really know who's going to survive to the end aside from probably Ripley and Newt, and who's going to get it from the aliens for being stupid, or who's going to get it in terms of like sacrificing themselves to save everyone. You know, just it's just great writing.
Yeah, well, writing was by James Cameron, so
yeah, he's gonna make movies, isn't he?
Yeah, well, they're not all solid gold.
Which ones are not the solid gold ones?
The ones that have subtitles that are in solid gold papyrus.
I don't know what that one is.
Dan.
What?
Avatar.
Oh, it's in papyrus?
It's in papyrus.
I don't remember that.
Oh my god, he was so criticized for that.
Must have missed that one. True Lies is good.
I like True Lies a lot, but I mean there are some weird scenes in that when you go back and watch it nowadays, but whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But
boy, looking at his IMDb is weird. Untitled Terminator 3, Untitled Terminator 2, Avatar 2, Avatar 3, Avatar 4, Avatar 5.
Yeah, apparently there are many things where he worked on things and then they never actually happened.
Well, those all say like pre-production / announced. That's peculiar.
Yeah.
Mm.
So anyway, this is also by producer Gail Ann Hurd, who is pretty infamous because they got married, James Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd. She also produced many of his films, The Abyss, Terminator, Terminator 2, this movie, Aliens. So they're a team.
Hmm.
We're a team. Past tense.
Right. I don't know what to say about this movie. It's too good. And then there's a lot of cool production design stuff that has been aped for decades, and a lot of quotable lines that everyone has heard, either whether they've seen the movie or not. And just every little bit of it is just like iconic and cool. I guess the question for you is, do you like this better than the first one?
I know that when we had talked about it, I had said that I liked it better than the first one. And I think I still do, only slightly, by the way. So I don't like put them worlds apart from one another. I consider Alien and Aliens to be on a more similar playing field than any of the other things that are in this universe, so to speak.
You mean the other Alien sequels / spinoff things?
Yeah, Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection and Alien vs. Predator and Alien vs. Predator 2 and Prometheus.
Well, you said James Cameron has an effects background, which probably helped him when making this movie. So it's a good thing that they hired someone who has an effects background to do the third one.
I thought he had a music video background.
He worked at ILM too.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, that's not even worth getting into.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into it next year, next October.
Oh, is that what we're going to do? We're going to do one Alien film per October?
I thought it was pretty obvious at this rate.
Well, we've only done two of them. I didn't know that like established the trend.
Well, it takes two to make a trendo.
Sure. So, do you like this one slightly more than the first one because it's like a more complete story that does more stuff? Or what do you think makes you like this one more?
I like this because it expands on the first one. I don't feel like it negates or trods all over the first one.
It didn't ruin the franchise / world for you.
No. I feel like it fleshes it out more and that it does so in a way that does not cheapen my appreciation of the original, which is very tricky to do for a sequel and very tricky to do for a sequel that is directed by someone else and a different crew from the previous endeavor, especially with so many years apart between them. It is not a trivial matter to do that, something like this. So I really applaud them for what they did.
Yeah. Like, they danced dangerously close to doing the 80s trope of making bad guy or good guy armor out of reused tires and stuff in the future. But it certainly does expand on it. And, I guess Ripley is expanded upon as well in the same way that the universe is. And, they take her in the exact direction that we would want them to take her. And she's still a leader, still sort of reluctant about things, but she really takes charge and kicks the crap out of some aliens in an awesome way.
Yeah.
And a power loader.
Man, that scene is iconic. And there are so many things about this film that are iconic, from the production design to the sound, the music, the design of the aliens and makeup, the design of the Marines equipment, even the language that they use to talk to one another, which is not, you know, like they're not real Marines talking like real Marines to one another. They're space Marines talking like space Marines to each other. And so, you know, you sit down to play a game like StarCraft, and all of the human Terran forces in that all sound like they're from the Aliens universe because it had such an influence. You go to play a game like Doom 3, I want to say.
Sure.
Sounds like a good name. And it has hallways that are basically like lifted from Sid Mead's hallways for the colony set.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you see stuff like this still reproduced to this day, where people are trying to strive for this sort of aesthetic. And I don't mean that to belittle anyone who's making things nowadays, but just to say that it is, it stands out in a way that has fostered a lot of replication. Like it is not something that it is a trendsetter, let's say. When it comes to things, and even though this is a sequel to a film, it is a trendsetter in that way. There are lots of things that come from the first film, of course, the design of the alien ship, the design of much about the alien design, even though not the forehead thing, like I said before, eggs and stuff, and the sort of weird hallways where we see that they have excreted some sort of resin to form that, and we of course see some of the other designs for the alien queen, who we have not talked about yet, who stands to, as a direct rival for Sigourney Weaver in the third act. And that is very iconic and important to this film. So I would not say that this film is some dated trash bin kind of a thing. It is something you need to watch knowing that it is made in the 80s, but it is made in such a way that people still harken back to what was set here.
Yeah, I think a big portion of it, at least for me, is, you know, the production design and stuff, a lot of it has been taken for other purposes as well, because it adds a lot to the feeling and the suspense of it. And I think that's something they sort of set up in the first one that they wanted to continue here, is just the environment really adds a lot of tension to the whole thing. And one of the scenes that, again, don't know if it's in the special edition or not, but I feel like I'd never seen before, is like the automatic guns outside the doors that they weld shut, and then like watching as the guns count down the bullets. I don't remember that at all, and it really sort of like it's terrifying in that you get the sense of like how many of these aliens are like coming after them in a hurry, and they're, you know, the automatic guns are doing a decent job of like deterring most of them, but it's a scope thing. Like, it makes you kind of feel the terror surrounding you a little bit more than just, you know, when they have the little sensor and they're coming through the roof or whatever, and you see all the little signatures on his little pad there. But I didn't remember that, and it was just like, oh my god, you know, you can see the flashes of them getting shot in the hallways, and you just see the guns counting down. And I thought that was an awesome way to just sort of go, holy crap, you guys are surrounded, you're probably gonna die. And then you get into the actual sort of like, you know, in the same room combat. But I thought that was an awesome sort of, again, just sort of using the environment and, you know, some of the props and stuff to add crazy suspense and tension to the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a good way to vary it, since we've seen the motion sensor so many times. And the robot sentries, I believe, are only in the special edition. But like I said, I believe that's the only version I've ever seen. I could be mistaken, though, because, you know, changing channels happen on all kinds of things. Now, let's go to, of course, the scene of them dropping. That is a parallel to the Nostromo from the first film, slowly landing through the atmosphere. In a very long scene, And this, it goes by lickety-split because they drop through the atmosphere in military precision. And they peel out of there in their remote control car over to the base. And we find out from this little bumpy ride that, of course, Hudson is still the Joker that we learned from the briefing. And we find out that everyone's still pretty apprehensive about the new boss. But we also find out that the new boss has only ever been on two combat missions, and this is his second. So that's important. It's an important fact.
Probably not wise to select him for something of this magnitude, but I guess, again, maybe they're just totally underestimating what they're up against.
It does seem like the company is underestimating them. I don't know why at this point, because it does seem highly suspicious that they would underestimate everything, that they've lost all of this stuff. It'd be like, yay, maybe just like put in a little extra effort. Maybe it's on purpose, though. Maybe they don't want to put in somebody who's too good, who would just nuke the planet from orbit, because it's the only way to be sure. And so they want to try something a little more controllable. So they land. The APC clears out. The ship takes off. There's a lot of VHS and miniatures in here.
I love that when they're sort of circling the building, though, they have those horrible old cameras that have the streaky hot spots from the lights, though. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Retro future tech. I like it.
It's not the future, but it was the 80s. And as for the miniatures, they often feel like they are at the wrong scale for me. So
that was in the first movie, too, wasn't it, though?
Yeah, but in this one especially, it feels like they're at the wrong scale because there are many more miniature shots in this one than there were in the first. Like the dropship circling the thing feels like a guy with a camera who's hovering over the set of the base.
Yeah, but it's all fuzzy and out of focus, so you can't really tell the scale of stuff.
No, not, but yeah, it doesn't sell it. But anyway, they get the APC out there. They have their video monitors and their health monitors. But this is an important expository piece of information to see this in action here for this first scene where they go and secure the main building. And they get into the complex. There's all the drippy holes in the ceilings and all kinds of interesting stuff is occurring, including apparently some hamsters. And they somehow have motion detectors that detect motion, but not each other for some reason. Not entirely clear to me.
Noise canceling motion detectors.
Noise canceling. That's nice. And so they
maybe it's made by Bose.
they get through this area partially, and then Gorman declares it secured. And Ripley's like, "Is that secured?" And he's like, "Yeah, it totally is." And then they go walk inside.
It's military protocol. We don't see anything. We do a little rounds. We're good.
Yeah. There's no sign of any human life here. Everyone seems to have met a violent end. We can't find any bodies. And there's just like half-eaten donuts and coffee cups and rain coming in through the ceiling. So totally come inside.
Those are the scenes that are this version's harken back to the first movie, where it's all just tension and people slowly creeping around, and just like I love that those scenes are long enough and slow enough that you can put yourself in their shoes and think like, what if you just walked into this room that's for some reason had a hole in the roof and it was raining and some guy's half drank cup of coffee and donut was sitting there? It's just like, that would unnerve me immensely, and then you have to continue forward and do your job. Like, I love those portions of this movie.
Yeah, also I like the film scoring here because it's almost entirely absent, and that is a technique that many people use when they're scoring films, is that you don't have music for very suspenseful, tense moments sometimes, because sometimes the music can actually put you at ease or lead you in such a way that you know the kind of mood you should be having. But if there's absolute silence, it can be incredibly unnerving. And if there's just the silence of the score and then some sound design of like dripping rain, forget about it.
They also do that in the, when she's when she grabs Newt and then she accidentally backs her way into the little queen room or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I looked down for something, I don't know, probably to find the remote or whatever. And the sound just faded out and I was like, oh boy, what's going on? You look up and she does that spin around and you hear the laying of the egg, gross slurpy sound thing. It's like, yeah, there you go.
Yep. And in here, there are the occasional like little beats of the soundtrack to let you know that the composer hasn't fallen asleep. but they just serve to sort of punctuate these moments. And they get control of the control tower. They lower the sort of shield window things, which are just rear screen projection things. and they get stuff back online. They're looking for the colonists. And they find the facehuggers inside of the med bay.
That's another thing that just sort of makes you wonder about the time that has elapsed, because clearly Newt's dad or whatever was patient zero and he got a facehugger on him because he went out to go look at the derelict ship or whatever. And he came back and they tried to take it off of him and he died. I think he was the one that they were talking about when they were reading the papers, or somebody was. But they had at least three of them in the glass jars, and one of them was alive. So, I mean...
No, two of them were alive.
Two of them were alive? Right, of course, two of them are alive, because we chased them around later.
And they believe there were three dead ones.
But, like, that's a lot of facehuggers for... At least in the beginning of the movie, we see one confirmed patient having been grabbed a hold of. So it makes you wonder... Did they go back out there? Did they go back out there a couple of times? Did the alien... Well, I guess, you know, the alien wouldn't have popped out and laid the eggs, because now that we know that's not how it works.
Yeah, but there were still eggs inside of the ship, though.
Right. So somebody had to go... Or at least four other people had to go back there.
Yeah. Well, rescue mission.
Sure.
Yeah.
If I was Newt's mom, I would have closed that door and made the 911 call inside and then just... left the other guy out in the rain, but that's me.
Well, some people do things in a panic, especially jump scares. And because there is that jump scare when Newt is talking to Timmy and then the door slams open. But anyway, back to things that happen later in the film. They go through the med bay, they find that there are a couple creatures still left alive, and we see them suckling at the glass, and it's just like, oh, that's creepy. And we have another motion beat on the tracker, and they go out into the hallway after it, and there's some fire to get the thing that moved, but you know, they move it out of the way because there was a little girl, and Ripley comes over and she's like, oh, come out, and then, you know, she doesn't want to, and then she bites Hicks's hand, and then they eventually find her inside of the little shelter she has in the air ducts, and Ripley takes her out of there. And they clean her up a little, give her some hot cocoa.
Force hugs her to make her calm down.
Well, it's hard to calm down a small child who's seen everyone around her systematically murdered over the course of several weeks. But so anyway,
if she were to see another human being, you think she would kind of be a little relieved?
I think she's in shock.
Probably.
Yeah, because she seems like she is in shock. And
the sight of something that doesn't have tentacles coming out all over it would be welcoming.
Yeah, well, it could be welcoming unless you think you're experiencing a dream or some other form of delusion, because it's been so many weeks of nightmares that you can't keep anything straight in your head anymore. But anyway, that's a pleasant thought to think about. And so they talk to her. They find out her name is actually Newt. She has a very strange way of talking. I have not quite nailed down what it is. At first, I thought she was like British and covering up an accent, but apparently she's from Panama City Beach, Florida. So maybe she's covering up a Southern twang, but I have no idea. But
can't trust those Floridians.
No, Florida's the worst. But she's a small girl who is not a terrific child actress, but she's trying. She has to play a somewhat more complicated role than most child actors do.
This was the only movie she was ever in.
She wasn't even in the... She wasn't Newt in Alien 3?
What? No.
They had a separate person play Newt?
You've seen Alien 3, right?
It was many years ago.
There's no living Newt in Alien 3.
But I thought there was a Newt.
There is a prosthetic body that they call Newt.
Oh.
She did.
Oh. Well, I mean, I know she's dead, but I thought they had her, like, play dead on in the morgue.
No, I think she's, like, burned and disfigured and junk and stuff, too.
Oh, well. Saves you some money, I suppose. But, anyway, spoiler alert for Alien 3, where everything you loved about this film has been destroyed.
Yeah, don't go see Alien 3 because it's terrible.
Yeah, next year. So
apparently she's in the making of Alien 3 video documentary, so that's peculiar. But she's not credited in the movie.
Okay.
Hmm.
So anyway, back to this one, which is better than Alien 3. they figure out that they've got the colony transponders all clustered over by the heating and cooling system over in the reactor and the main terraforming building thing. The thing that looks like evil building number one. I question the production design of that somewhat because it is a little like purposefully ominous.
From the outside?
What?
From the outside?
Yeah. It's all pointy. It's basically got horns all over it. It's like, hi, I'm evil. There's evil things in me, but you know, whatever. They go drive over there and they're like, yeah, Marines go. And there's very dramatic Marine music for this. And they're checking their monitors and everything. And you think it's just going to be just like how they took the complex. Of course, you don't actually think that because you know that everything's going to go horribly wrong. But they pull in.
It's like they're having a damn town hall meeting in there.
So to speak. And they pull in, or the remote control vehicle version of the APC pulls in, and you know, it's a nice little effect of the gun lowering down the back of it so that it can fit inside of the thing, for you know overhead clearance purposes. They go up to an area, and the Marines get out and they go walking through, and Burke, Sigourney Weaver, and Gorman are left inside of the APC. And I wonder if Gorman's a reference to Roger Corman. But anyway, because that was one of Jim Cameron's bosses. But so anyway, they have them walk through
talking smack about his resolve,
perhaps. So they go walking through hallways and stuff, and you know it looks very. Power plant-y, with lots of pipes and stuff and steam, so much steam. And then they start seeing stuff that's not really like the power plant. And Sigourney Weaver doesn't know what it is either because she didn't go inside the alien ship. For the audience, it seems awfully familiar because it seems very reminiscent of the sort of vertebra-like designs of the interior of the derelict ship. It's not identical or anything, but you know, this is close enough. Mm-hmm. And they start going through this thinking, yeah, sure, let's keep walking.
And just as things start getting bad, they go from bad to worse very quickly by adding a lot of suspense by Ripley pointing out that they're underneath a giant fusion reactor and they probably shouldn't be firing off explosive tipped rounds in there, so they should all take their magazines away and give them to the one guy. And only use their flamethrowers in emergency.
Yeah, well, Gorman does a piss poor job of explaining why this is happening.
Just do what I said. It's like, yeah, it's all orders. It's no explanation.
Yeah, he's not a good boss. That point is very well driven home through this process. Opone, who plays basically the more experienced leadership here, is actually in with the team, and he reluctantly goes along with the command to take everybody's magazines, and so they stop in the middle of this secreted alien resin and take the magazines, and they're going to only use flamethrowers, and they go proceed forward.
He chews on a lot of cigars in this movie.
I love when he wakes up from hypersleep and he has a cigar in his hand and he puts it in his mouth immediately. That is it is an amazing character affectation.
Yeah, I like the one when Ripley's all like, look at me, I can do the loader, and he's chewing on his cigar like it's basically a stick of gum.
Oh, it's so good. I really love Appone. I think, unfortunately, he dies far too early in the film. But, you know, it's necessary, of course, because that's when everything goes to crap. And so you can't have an experienced guy around anymore. Otherwise, the rest of them doing what they do would seem less believable as people in charge. So you got to get rid of all the people in charge. And they do. Because, unfortunately, they happen upon a colonist who has their chest burst open. And then they happen across another colonist who has their chest burst open. And then they happen across another colonist who just has their head down. And they pick up the head. And then wide-eyed. And then kill me. Because that's ominous. And rather than killing them, they sort of wait around and they're like, oh, this is the thing. And then chest burster scene. And you can see back when they cut to Ripley, who's watching this unfold, she's covering up her own chest because she's had this same nightmare so many times since the death of John Hurt in the first film. So she's upset and rattled, and everyone is freaking out at this point. They use the flamethrower to set the colonist and the chest burster on fire.
Which does a great job of waking up everything else that's sleeping above them.
And this is the really great thing about the design of this place, is that you don't realize how embedded in the architecture the aliens are until they start, like, writhing around. Now, some of these shots, of course, you see them first and foremost, very clearly, but some of the other darker ones, it's nice to see something rattle around back there. And
it's like the end of the first one, where they're kind of, like, hidden inside of the pipes and the machinery, and they just come slithering out and coming after you.
Yeah, well, the end of the first one, that was pretty obvious, because there was nothing like that.
Not a whole lot of things xenomorph head-shaped in the escape ship.
No, not so much. But in here, where everything's a little off kilter from the secretions, then the architecture leaves some more little hiding places for these nefarious little people. And one of the scenes I love is the Marine who turns around to face camera talking about how they're not sure that they show up on infrared. And of course, the audience, the whole entire time she's talking, sees the xenomorph in the wall above her. And just as she spins around to face camera, the xenomorph has sort of lunged out of the wall towards her and clobbers her. And there's so much shooting and so much fire and so much stuff. And it just all goes to crap. It all goes to crap.
I'm sure they were all terrified, but they would have done well to look up a little bit earlier.
Yeah, well, it's hard to see in there. It's so dark. But everything goes to crap. And Gorman doesn't know how to handle the situation. He just sort of mumbles about how they need to lay down suppressing fire and get back to the APC. And Ripley's like, yeah, you just need to tell him to get out of there, get out of there. And then he doesn't do it. And
like, they've already started shooting and he's attempting to hold on to his leadership position by like, just like, yes, shoot stuff and then escape. And they're like, they can't hear him. They're not listening at all. He's just like, yes, do that thing that you're already doing. I told you to do that, right? And then please escape.
Yeah. And because Appone can't actually hear his mumbly long directions, he actually stops to hear what he's saying, and that gets Appone killed because he's not paying attention. He's trying to pay attention to his directions that he's being given. And when Appone dies, then everything's just like a free-for-all. And there's guns being fired, even though they weren't supposed to be firing guns, and there's explosions and all kinds of stuff. Mayhem. Absolute mayhem. And Ripley is not having any of this because Gorman is basically letting his whole team die by just sort of sitting there mumbling to himself. So she freaks out. She gets up in the front of the APC and hauls butt through these corridors, or the remote control car does anyway.
It's not the most nimble of cars, but yeah, she does a pretty good job of it.
Yeah. And so they go careening through these pipe-laden corridors. Down to a wall of secretion, bust through it. Paul Reiser does his part and holds back Gorman, saying, you know, he had his chance. And they open up the door, get the Marines back inside who are still left. There's some alien stuff of them jumping and exploding in acid from the exploding tips of the specific rifles that they have. And of course, shuttle, that causes some problems when they try to shut the door and there's an alien there and he explodes in acid and douses Hudson. And, you know, Drake is dead and Vasquez is forlorn, shall I say.
She gets a little bit of acid on her leg or something, too. Or is that later? I thought she got a little splatter on the arm in that instance, too.
No, Hudson gets it on the arm, and then she gets acid on her later when they're in the vents and stuff.
Yeah.
But
pretty great way to put an end to that alien, though, like just using a boot, putting its face up against the wall and shooting it. But the acid blood.
Minor drawback.
Pretty good defense mechanism if you had to pick one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really want to be full of acid blood, though, because that requires me being dead. So I don't want that. I don't feel like I need to be a teachable lesson for more of me, because there aren't any. But there is the, you know, running and gunning, and they get out of there, and Ripley is so full of adrenaline from hauling butt back out of the facility and running over the alien who tried to, like, crash in through the window and get her, that she just keeps running and running and running on the APC over the rocks, and they broke the transaxle and they're just grinding metal and they just need to stop and get out of there.
No, I'd be like, grind the metal as far as this thing will go and get us out of here and then we'll move.
Yeah. So they get outside, they call for the pickup from the airship, the dropship.
And of course, these dummies parked somewhere on the planet with their little door, their little flappy entrance door open.
There's no part of that makes any sense to me.
No, they were smart in the beginning there, where they just sort of like hovered for a second and the car flew out, and then they're like, all right, later, we're getting out of here.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things where they're like, oh, the area is secured, but it's like, really? Like, so secured you would just leave a giant door open, but they do. And
seems like that might be against protocol, especially in a situation like this.
Yeah, well, somebody made a mistake. Somebody made a big bleeping mistake. And so he gets up there, the guy running up the ramp, and he sticks his hand in some KY jelly stuff and goes, ew, gross. And then the pilot's all like, oh, hey, where are you going? Why aren't you up here yet? And then the door opens, and she's like, oh, what took you so long? And then it's an alien. Surprise. And then they crash.
I didn't particularly like her character, mostly because she was wearing aviators when they were flying into the atmosphere. And, you know, if you want to go all Top Gun while you're flying a jet, that's fine. But you're in space and it's not really that bright.
It's an affectation. The thing about it that's humorous to me is that the dropship dialogue in StarCraft is basically like lifted word for word from this dropship pilot. So if you've ever played that game, just all of the same lines.
No, I didn't play that game.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people did, Dan, because people have taste, except for you.
I don't do video games.
Okay. But so they crash, and there's a big rear screen projection of a miniature crashing on a planet surface projected behind everybody running away from the rear screen projection.
Almost would have been cooler if you didn't even see the alien getting her and you just saw the ship coming at him and like start swerving and crash.
Yeah, I think that him sticking his hand in the goo is enough of a clue.
Yeah.
That you could have just left it at that and done it with the rest of the imagination. But
there's two instances in the movie, that one and then when Burke gets it, where they do the close-up of the vibrating, angry, drooling face right before it attacks somebody, and I don't particularly love that shot of the aliens.
I think it's because it doesn't really look lifelike, I want to say. That's not really applicable to these sorts of things. They're not alive, of course. They're not any sort of reference that we would have.
I guess it's not really what you would expect them to do.
No. It's just that the whole head sort of shakes as one unit, and the lips and stuff all kind of move as if they were wires underneath the surface pulling back. So you can kind of see the mechanism more than you see the intent at life here. But that you know, it's a drawback of what you could do in the 80s. But they have...
I would have been happier with like a cheesy like shadow of an alien shape like rises up over top of her, and you never even see the reversal shot of the alien. She just looks back with the shadow over her, and then, you know, crash.
Okay.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, keep with the suspense and the tension and stuff. Those are the parts of the alien movies that I really enjoy.
I'm fine with it. It doesn't really bother me as much as it bothers you, but I understand you being bothered.
It's Jaws. I don't want to see the aliens unless I need to see the aliens.
Okay. We'll just replace all the aliens with walkie-talkies. So they crash, and there's a rear screen explosion, and everybody runs away. And then, you know, it's game over, man. It's game over. Infamous line. And they get out of there. They get all the stuff from the APC, go back to the main complex.
I like that after the ship crashes, they're just picking up small smoldering pieces of metal and looking at it like, this was the ship, man.
Well, you know, they had a tough day.
Yeah, I know, but like, if a plane crashes, you don't just go like pick up a piece of metal and be like, oh, look at this.
Okay, well, I mean, it's not like the space FAA is going to show up.
I know, I just thought it was goofy. Like, look at these pieces of the ship that has just crashed behind us that is not a model or a rear projection.
Point taken. And so they get back to the main complex. They start securing it and trying to figure out, like, how long they can hold out for a rescue mission to come. And their estimates are 17 days. Like I said earlier, I have no idea how long it takes to go anywhere in this. Or why 17 days would be the clue that, like, at what point in those 17 days would there have been, like, a, hey, something went wrong clue? Like, how long does that round trip communication take? That doesn't seem like you'd be sending out over radio, but whatever.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, if they don't hear from you in 17 days, then they come and get you, so it would be beyond that, but I guess the military would probably want to communicate a little bit more frequently than that, so I think it would be like, well, they didn't check in within 2 or 3 straight days, and then now it takes us 14 days to get there, whatever. So that's how long it'll take total.
Maybe. But like I said, doesn't necessarily make any sense. It just sets up a certain deadline that conflicts with another deadline, because Bishop notices that there is exhaust venting from the reactor, because maybe some of the things that they had just done in the previous scene might have damaged some important equipment that regulated the temperature of the reactor. So they estimate that 4 hours from now, the whole place will be vaporized. This is bad.
As if they needed another ticking clock. Yeah, that whole fusion reactor thing full of alien bugs is going to explode.
Yeah. So they fortify themselves, they hunker down, and they try to get out of there within these 4 hours by sending Bishop out through a tube to go remote pilot down the remaining dropship from the Sulaco so they can get out of there. And that'll give them enough time to hopefully stay alive, but make it to the ship and leave before the explosion happens.
Yeah. I like that Bishop takes the Andy Dufresne way out of the building.
That is a really uncomfortable shot to watch.
Especially because they immediately weld him back into the tube.
Oh, God. It's just like you feel like, even if you're not claustrophobic, you feel like you are trapped watching that shot, because it is framed in such a way where you feel like you're in the tube. Like that is it is unsettling. And
yeah, James Cameron saw Die Hard and he's like, oh, yeah, we'll make it smaller and round. Take that.
Die Hard is after this.
It is?
Yes.
What?
Yes. Do you know how I know Die Hard is after this?
Oh my God. Wow. How did I just do that?
Do you know how I know that?
Because we've talked about it and it's a very famous movie.
And well, also because they used one of James Horner's music cues from Aliens in Die Hard, because what's his face didn't like Michael Kamen's music score moment there for the bad guy at the very end of the film.
Hmm.
So that's why all of a sudden it's a music beat from Aliens at the end of Die Hard.
Oh, that's right. You pointed that out when we talked about it.
Yeah.
Hmm. See, Die Hard, it's a favorite movie of mine. And what I did is I swapped the year I was born with the movie. Anyway.
So what year was that movie released, Dan?
88.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they had been working on it for like 7 years ahead of time, though, just like this one.
Yes. sure it took a really long time to green light. So they, and of course, there's an important connection with John McTiernan and the Alien franchise in Predator. But we'll get to that later, shall I say.
Yeah. Mm. John McTiernan.
Yeah. Just one of those
What?
I was doing one of those pantomimed, like, necktie pulling things. Yeah.
I was going to say, try and get something from him greenlit these days.
Yeah. He has some
take a little while.
He has some interesting personal problems in his real life, so that's a thing. But anyway, they make this plan, send Bishop out there. The robot sentries are all set up. They're firing as aliens are coming down hallways. There's the scenes in the med bay where first Ripley drops off Newt and then goes back off to go do stuff. And she tells Burke, under no circumstances are we taking these tubes of crap with us. And then he's like, but they're really important to bio weapons research. So we should totally do it.
We could make so much money.
And then she's like, yeah, no, definitely not.
The only thing that this movie is missing is a scene where, like, she sneaks into a room to find Burke, like, on a secret cell phone that she didn't know he had, like, talking to the leadership of the company, going like, yeah, they're totally here. I'm going to try and sneak him back on the plane, and here's what the plan's going to be.
No, the only thing this movie is missing is that he walks into a secret room where the leadership of the company has been hiding the entire time, and there's a med pod in there.
And they're really old and sleeping and stuff.
Yeah. Anyway...
And then he goes, hello, father. Ugh, God. It's a big ship. I mean, you can hide rooms and stuff in places.
Yeah.
You never even notice until you get your electric bill at the end of the month. You're like, why? We use this much electricity? Who is taking this many showers?
I don't think that's how that works. so they're executing their plan. And Ripley also gets a quick weapons tutorial from Hicks. On how to use their marine weapon with the grenade launcher, and he's all like, oh, you're not going to need to know how to use that, and she's like, oh, you know, show me everything, and it's just like, ooh, innuendo.
I like how they have that scene where there's like a little bit of a connection between them, and then after that it's like, nope, sorry.
And he gives her the tracking bracelet, and she gives the tracking bracelet to Newt because she's like, I don't care about me, I care about this kid. But then somehow Michael Biehn knows later in the film that he gave she regifted the tracking marker. even though there was no scene where she said that to him, and there was no scene where he knew that from Newt or something, but whatever. So they're all set up and ready to go. There's weapons firing, but they're okay. Things keep pulling back. Ripley finally goes to go take a nap with Newt. She crawls underneath the bed. She puts her rifle on top. Then she wakes up, and there are little plastic bins rolling inside of the room. And she's a little unsettled by that. And there's a great shot of her from underneath the bed, and the camera is in the front of the bed, moving up, and you see her hand from behind the bed reach up over the top of the bed, searching for the rifle, and it's gone. Love that shot. Because she is screwed. She is proper screwed.
Mm-hmm.
And they have her wake up Newt as calmly as she can, say, we are in trouble. And, you know, let's get out of here. And there's a facehugger that jumps out, and she captures it underneath the bed very briefly before it breaks out of there. They keep trying to, like, break the glass, knock the glass. Like, there is so much tension in this scene where you're just like, oh, crap. And of course, Burke turns off the monitors that are viewing medbay. So, you know,
he's a bad guy.
Yeah, he's not a good person.
There are brief glimmers of distracting hope in him earlier in the movie. You know, like when he, you know, pushes Gorman out of the way so she can drive the car and stuff. You kind of think he's an okay human being for a second. But yeah, this scene, along with the tension, really just sort of cinches it for him. Just the taking the gun, putting it just outside the window, locking him in there, turn off the monitors. It's like, yeah, it's bad.
Yeah. And Ripley gets them over by the glass wall, tries to break it, can't, then comes up with the solution that she'll use her lighter. She's been using to light horrible cigarettes inside of space stations and small confined spaces.
Smoking will save your life sometimes,
I guess. Or just carry a lighter at all times, I suppose. But she uses her lighter to set off the fire alarm, and that gets everyone's attention. And they all peel off down to med bay, break the glass, get in there, shoot up the aliens, kill them. Shoot up the facehuggers, kill them. And they get Ripley and Newt, and Ripley is gasping for breath because she's just been basically throttled by this the tail of one of the facehuggers. And she manages to say Burke's name, and they go capture him. And then Burke is there, covered in sweat, because he's a little nervous, because Burke is guilty.
She does lay out his plan pretty well. Like, I mean, you know, we're meant to believe all of it, and I think we do, but it's just like, he was going to impregnate us and sneak us on the ship, because he wants these things, and it's the only way he can make it happen. He's just like, come on, you sound crazy. What are you doing? You can't do that. And the military guys are understandably like, yeah, maybe we should, like, you know, Hudson's all on board with just, like, shooting him right there. But it's like, well, the leap that she makes that I don't quite get is, like, he was going to be able to do it because, like, once you guys go into cryosleep, he's going to fire your tubes out into space. And, like,
well, he was going to sabotage their tubes.
Right. Like, yeah. Well, okay. How is he going to do that? What evidence do you have for that? You just, like, assume he's just going to kill them while they're sleeping or something?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
It's a fair assumption, I guess, but...
Yeah, it seems like a plan that was in motion that he was going to figure out as it went along. His priority that he really wanted to get those alien embryos back through quarantine so that the company could have them.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. That's why we needed that scene where he was quietly having a cell phone conversation in his little private room.
No, we didn't need it because I feel like he's representative enough of the company. Now, in the first film, the company's represented by Ash... because there are instructions which are delivered from the company to do these things, to go set down an LV-426, to go to this location, to check out this thing, and the crew is expendable, you know, for no particular reason. And Ash has to execute on all of this. So then it places the burden somewhere and like, oh, well, is it Ash's fault or is it the company... Like, was Ash just being too literal with their instructions? Like, how expendable is expendable in this situation, I suppose? Whereas in this one, it's like, there is a human being who is willing to screw over other human beings in order to accomplish greedy little goals. And that makes it much more clear that the company, and by extension, Paul Reiser, is evil. Because he really... has other alternatives, and he chooses to be a greedy little jerk.
Right, because he basically admits to sending Newt's family out there to go investigate the ship without making it a big emergency thing first, because if he would have done a big emergency report up the chain, then he wouldn't have been able to keep anything that he found, and, you know, the ownership thing is what's important to him, is because he wants to own the rights to the alien bodies and stuff, so he can make the money off of them. And that's not a super great thing to do, since he basically killed 150 or so people.
Yeah. Bioweapons, yay! Well, it's 50 to 70 families, so they don't really lay out exactly how that functions. But so anyway, he's horrible. And they have an impromptu little trial here where they're like, let's kill him. And then Sigourney Weaver speaks up and says no. And then the power gets cut, fortunately for Paul Reiser. And Gorman watches Paul Reiser as the aliens encroach upon their space. And this is a very famous scene because there's the motion detector, which, of course, is inherited from the first film but upgraded. And they see the dots approaching the doorway, and he's reading off the distance that they are from them. And then there's eventually a point where they start reading off a distance that is inside of the room. And she's like, that can't be. Like, they'd be in here. Like, there's no way. And Michael Biehn Hicks climbs up on top of a cargo container, opens up the drop ceiling, and sees, like, six or seven aliens, like, dangling from the ceiling, crawling through the drop ceiling area up above them. And so then he falls down, shoots through the ceiling, aliens drop to the ceiling, total chaos. Everything has gone to crap. Burke makes an escape to the med lab because he knows that's where they're going to go, and he locks the door behind them because at this point everyone is against him. And he is going to be greedy and try to get to the ship himself, and that way he won't get in trouble. This is priority right now. This does not work well for him, and he also screws over everybody else.
Yeah, he seems like he's on the verge of, like, he probably has that in the back of his head, like, maybe I can get to the ship and get out of here on my own or something. But at this point, he's basically just running away from people and, like, trying to lock them in the rooms. And he's just like, I don't know what to do. I'm just going to go over here now. And then he gets well, not really eaten. He gets presumably a hole punched in his face by a tiny mouth.
It's one of those overused aliens tropes that I wish I would see less of.
With the punching the holes in the head with the tiny
mouth? Yeah.
Yeah, originally it was just supposed to be intimidating, and then they, you know, that became their weapon of choice.
Yeah.
Never mind the fact that they have giant teeth and, like, claws and stuff and are strong, and the tails with the stabby bit.
Yeah. Never mind the rest of the fact that they're a horrible murder machine. Everybody wants to see the tiny mouth. So they go through the process of trying to get out of this room. They, like, start trying to cut through the door lock. They get out into the little cubby area that has also been locked, and they don't have enough time to seal the door and also cut through the other door. So then Newt figures out there's an air conditioning duct that they can go through. They climb through there after they seal a door, and they start making a bunch of turns. And at this point, we're down to just Vasquez, Hicks, Gorman, Newt, and Ripley. And Burke dies because a door slowly opens behind him, slower than any door inside of the complex, and reveals an alien who does the tiny mouth murder. And then they get through the hallways of little air conditioning corridors to a spinning blade fan room. And up above is a ladder. So Sigourney Weaver rests her foot on it. They hop Newt over to it. And Michael Biehn's right behind her. And then back in the maze of air ducts, Vasquez and Gorman are trying to get away from the aliens. They're surrounded on all sides. Vasquez has been wounded by acid, and Gorman tried to rescue her. There's the grenade that Gorman has, and he takes it out, arms it, and they both hug it for dear death, and then they explode. And their explosion rocks the little fan blade thing, which knocks Newt off of the ladder onto the fan blade thing down the little chute on the side. And they try to reach for her, and they get the jacket, and they pull the jacket, and then they have a jacket.
She slides very slowly down the air thing. It's kind of annoying.
It's, what are you going to do? You
can't reach. A lot of shouting, a lot of cutting back and forth.
Yeah, and Michael Biehn is like, don't worry, I have my Seiko wristwatch. I know exactly where she is. And he doesn't have any previous knowledge of the fact that she has the tracker that he had given to Ripley. So again, like I said, that's a little weird. But they go off after her. They get back into the corridors. They're just running around like they haven't a care in the world except where Newt is. And it's a little strange considering the fact that they're basically surrounded by the xenomorph aliens all over through the walls and whatever. They go through this thing, and she's underneath them, the water, and there's a very famous shot of an alien coming up underneath as they're trying to cut through the grate, and you see the tail come up first, and that's because the wire pulled it up first, and then the alien body comes up, and it's menacing. It's pretty menacing. No more kid. And there's a little doll head by the time that they break through the grate. And then Sigourney Weaver freaks out. Ripley is very upset. She's got to get Newt. She'll, you know, stop at nothing to get Newt. And Hicks is like, yeah, I know that. Totally on the same page, except for the fact that we're totally going to die if we stay here. So we need to get out. And so he pulls them back to the elevator. They try to shut the elevator door. In true elevator door fashion, an unwanted guest approaches before they can shut it. And
naturally.
Yeah, and they got to shoot it. It sprays acid all over Hicks. He is wounded.
Got to pull his armor off as fast as possible. Although it looked like his armor was being held on by like a little tiny gold like master lock too, which I thought was kind of funny. I don't know why that was there.
It seemed tenuous. They got it off, and he's limping and in pain. They get out onto the landing platform. they get over to Bishop, and he says that the ship is landing right now. They get on board the ship, and she's like, oh, yeah, we're totally not leaving yet because we got 26 more minutes, and we're going to go F around inside of the exploding reactor.
I like how specific they can be with the countdown clock, even though they're not really entirely sure when it's going to explode.
Yeah, because they've lost all like basic communication controls with the thing, but he's estimating 26 minutes. And so they get over there. Fortunately, the computer voice inside of the facility announces very loudly how much time is left.
Mm-hmm. Very helpful.
Yeah, you gotta reach minimum safe distance. So they land on top of a precarious platform. There is a shot of the dropship approaching the reactor, which is pretty infamous. There's a big music cue, like everything's swelling behind it. There's the optical lightning and stuff all over the place, and the dropship unfortunately has like a 10-foot mat line around it, and it drives me nuts when I look at it. But
yeah, it doesn't help that it's just sort of like lingering there in the center frame too.
No, and especially since it's so high contrast behind it, it's not like it's a mat lines over space with some stars is significantly more forgiving than mat lines over buildings that are front illuminated by lights. But anyway, they get inside, they land on the thing, she goes and takes freight elevator down.
Don't forget her Rambo montage of taping the two guns together and putting on her shoulder holster and getting all of her flares and stuff.
Yeah, because remember, she had a 5-minute briefing on how this gun worked. So
right. Well, and then she got the flamethrower and taped it to the gun, and it's very much a like, all right, Ripley means business now. Like she takes the jacket off and throws it on the ground and stuff, and it's just like, it's full blown like action movie at this point.
Yeah, and so she is going out into the facility. There is a brief moment between Ripley and Hicks where they finally say their first names to one another. She says Ellen, and then he says Dwayne. And you know, that's
the thing people do. They let people in by telling them their first names.
My first name's Joe.
We don't know each other that well. I'm not going to tell you mine.
Okay. I'll just keep guessing.
Okay.
Andrew. So they...
That's Corporal Andrew to you.
So they get inside the facility. She's going through the elevator, strapping more things, tying more things, putting bolero things, I don't know, holster things on. There's stuff happening. Rear screen projection of a facility as they're going down an elevator. She gets down to the bottom floor, because that's where she had just guessed, I suppose. They go out. She goes down some stairs. She doesn't find anything, but she's sending out little flicks of the flamethrower in order to clear her path. Make sure there's no wall decorations out to get her. She gets
dropping flares, and you know, as she winds her way through the corridor, so she can find her way back.
Yeah, she's Hanseling and Gretel in her way. it is of very little use to her because she gets over to where the tracker is and finds that the tracker is not with Newt, and she's all given up on this and sad. And then she hears Newt shrieking because Newt has just woken up cocooned, and there's a egg in front of her that is opening up with gooey crap inside of it. And she's yelling her little lungs out. Ripley runs over, blasts the crap out of that egg. An alien runs down the hall. She blasts the crap out of that alien running down the hall. There's more blasting crap out of things. She smashes the resin restraints that are holding Newt in, pulls her out of the slime, and then she wants to go back the way she came, but there's an explosion that blocks her way, and she's got to go a different path. Unfortunately, this different path takes her through a bit of an area that is full of slightly more eggs, and in addition to slightly more eggs, there's the thing that it might be laying the eggs, which had been conjecture up until now, that there might be something like an ant queen, but not like that, because ant, you know, ants don't have hives or whatever, that whole line of dialogue. And then
such a great reveal, though. Like you said, the music dies down. She's surrounded by the eggs. You see the little weird taily bits dropping the goopy egg on the ground. You follow the giant, like, squishy egg sac all the way up to the queen.
I believe it is called an ovipositor.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Because it deposits ovum?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah, the Latin root of gross. So they... they get back over to the finally reveal the alien queen, who is, I guess, catching some Z's in the midst of the reactor exploding. And she's all folded up, like big arms folded in, little arms folded in, legs doing whatever, ovipositor positing. Her head is recoiled inside of her helmety part of her shell.
She not only has a tiny mouth, she also has a head that comes out of her head.
Yeah, that is quite a trick, really. So she starts
it's heads and mouths all the way down.
So she starts waking up, and there's a nice little gush of crap that comes out as she juts her jaw out of that, and slowly starts flexing and moving around. Some aliens run up, and Ripley's like, "Don't do it, or I'll blow this thing up." She doesn't say that, but she just gestures towards the thing.
I like it. She's like slowly walking back. Yeah, just little burst of the fire, so the other little aliens know not to get in there and mess around. And she like waves them off, like, "Okay, please don't set all of my eggs on fire." Slowly walking back, and she's like, "Yeah, don't care. Just torch everything. Start shooting grenades into the Ova thingy mabob. Just start blasting the crap out of everything." And it's just like, "Nope, sorry, we're done here. Later."
Yeah. This is a problem, because if she had not done this, then the alien queen might not have pursued her.
Yeah, she could have just let everything blow up.
Yeah, because I think
at this point she's pretty much hell bent on making sure that everything is destroyed.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty good chance of that happening.
Yeah, but you know, you never know. Yeah. The only way to be sure. Well, I guess way to be sure is the nuke it from orbit.
So they
didn't even do. They just let it blow up. I would have nuked it again.
Maybe she did. That happened after. It was just cut.
That happened after Newt said, "I'm going to take a nap," and then it just went cut to credits.
Yeah. So they get back to the elevator. She's pushing all the buttons for the elevators because they're not coming down fast enough. Apparently it went back up or something. I guess somebody else had pushed the button for the elevator.
Gotta take the express elevators.
Yeah, so the elevator slowly comes back down. The alien queen is stomping after them because she has lost her ovipositor, and she is full-on angry. They get one of the elevators down. She gets inside just in time. They close and head on up. And then this is the first time in an Aliens film where we see something from the perspective of an alien. So we see the queen looking over towards the other elevator that came down, and it opens, and she looks at it, and she cocks her head to the side and then goes in to go up, assuming that that is what that did, showing that they are a little smarter than you might think.
You think it pushed, like, top floor button when it got in?
I don't know what it did, to be perfectly honest. The intelligence of the aliens is always kind of nebulous, because it seems like they're very street smart, shall I say, but not always, like, you know, smart in the sense of like learning the English language smart, but who knows? We see so seldom of them.
Yeah, they're animal predator smart, so they know how to kill things and eat things. But as Sneakums in the chat mentioned, the elevator probably had a home floor. They probably always hung out on the maintenance level there where the ships drop stuff off. So that's probably a reasonable explanation.
Yeah, it could be. So they get up there. They get over towards the ship just as she's coming up. They get up there, and she's like, "Bishop!" And she's angry. And then Bishop comes in.
The android double-crossed him again.
Yeah, and surprise, didn't. The ship comes up just in time to rescue them from the alien queen who's come up the elevator. They get on board. There is an explosion that rattles the ship. It goes over and knocks into some rubble and whatever, and they blast off out of there.
But it can't close its little feet bits because some stuff got stuck in there.
Yeah, just stuff. They get back up to altitude, they get inside the Sulaco, you know, they did a good job, they get out of there. They need to get a stretcher for Hicks, so don't move him yet. Important. They leave him secured, go down the ramp. And unfortunately, the alien queen drops a little acid from above. Bishop looks up just in time to get an alien queen tail blade through his chest. Then he is elevated up and split in two by arms that barely seem to exert any force on top of his body as it flies apart. That's fine. Just the 80s. And he goes flying.
Full of milky tubes.
So Ripley and Newt run screaming back from that. Newt crawls inside of a thing. Ripley goes inside of a door, closes the door. And the alien queen goes after her. Then once the door is closed and she can't get after Ripley, she turns towards Newt, who she knows is still inside the room, starts sniffing her out, pulling up floor grates. And Ripley is concerned about this. And, of course, we see the loader, Chekhov's loader, she saw at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, it was in Bay 22 as well, I think.
Yeah, and so that opens up. And there is a backlit shot with so much smoke and fog that makes no sense.
It's so awesome looking, though.
Yeah, and this is a line in the film that I believe is criminal to bleep, and I can't even imagine what they replace it with for the TV broadcasts of this that occurred on like CBS or whatever. But you know, that it is amazing, and it is often quoted, and it is iconic for this because she tells the other lady that she is not so nice and to get away from her.
I don't think they bleep that on television.
Yeah. So they knock her. They start knocking around with the loader and the alien queen, slashing and crashing and pinching and stuff. And then they finally get over towards the airlock. Ripley opens the airlock with the remote. She drops the alien queen into it. The alien queen grabs the harness part of the loader, pulls in the loader. And all of this is expertly done, considering they're enormous puppets. Huge, yeah. Puppets. They're not small puppets. They're big puppets. These are not itty bitty little things.
It's an awesome fight scene too, because like it's slow because of, you know, the robotics of the loader and stuff too. But yeah, it's a nicely done fight scene. And you know, she's holding the face with the claws, and the tiny mouth is lashing out. And once they fall into the airlock, it's like, well, now you're screwed, you stupid queen alien, because you got a giant loader on top of you.
Yeah, and Ripley gets out of there, but before she can get up to the top level and safely close the top door, she has her Reebok attacked by the alien queen. She's got a good foothold on her, so to speak. And Ripley
really
uses...
is a shame. Those Reeboks are going for so much money on eBay right now.
I still think it's interesting you look that up.
Oh, they're awesome. They came out in April on Alien Day. Because 30-year anniversary or whatever, they have high tops and mid tops. I totally want a pair, but they're like $1,000 on eBay.
Wow.
Yeah. Also, I'm not a size 6.5, so that would be a little difficult. Same thing happened with the stupid Back to the Future shoes, man. They made like 50 pairs, and now they're like thousands of dollars.
Oh. Well, that's how collector's items work.
Why can't they just sell a bunch of them? They would sell a lot of them. Just make some. I want to buy some Ripley Reeboks.
Then they're not collector's items.
Yeah, but they're just cool shoes that a lot of people would buy.
I guess. So, anyway.
It's not like Reebok sold them for a ton of money. It's just jerks on eBay are selling them for a ton of money.
This one gets lost out of an airlock because Ripley opens the airlock door from the mid-level emergency release, which sets off a bunch of lights. And Bishop Torso goes sliding across the grating.
Is that his new official name, Bishop Torso?
Well, I mean, he's half the man he used to be. He goes.
The song wasn't out yet.
He goes skidding across until he finally manages to get his fingers into one of the grates and hold on. And Newt is also trying to hold on, but you know, slips, and Bishop catches her. The door finally is open long enough for the queen to get expelled along with the shoe. Then Ripley has to climb up to close it, which doesn't seem like a good safety procedure. If you have something where you can open it there, it seems like you just simply should close it there. I've never understood this. So she gets up to the top, hits the button that closes the thing, and it requires like two button presses. And it's not like, hey, there's a giant hole in the ship, close it. Like, I think that it should be an easy button. But anyway, she pushes the two buttons it requires to close that, and then it starts sealing up, and Day is saved, and Bishop says, not bad for a human. As he spurts, you know, milk out of himself. And she's happy because she's come to peace with androids.
Yeah, he did all right. He helped out and stuff.
And I honest to God, love the twist of the android being a good guy in this one. Like, mm-hmm. if it had been another bad guy, I think that would have been a disappointment.
And he plays it straight enough that you have the confusion along the way that maybe he could turn, but he's just a very straightforward, honest dude most of the time. Then he helps out at the end there.
Yeah, and he is extremely selfless through the course of the film. And there are those scenes that are meant to throw you off a little bit where, especially in the med bay, when he's delivered the supplies and he's all like not paying attention to the supplies he's been delivered. But
oh, yeah, it's very much reminiscent of Ash, who was just sort of like, oh, yeah, look at this thing here. I'm going to ignore you now.
Yeah. So, you know, it was on purpose and they tried to play it both ways. But of course, it was Burke who was the evil guy. And it was Bishop who was the good guy. And
never trust a company man in a wool blazer with a pop collar.
Can I quote you on that?
Sure.
So they blast off out of there. You go back into the hypersleep tubes. Bishop is bagged and tagged and ready to go for I don't know what. I don't know. It's a refurb program for him or something. But he's set. And Newt goes into a hypersleep tube. Sigourney Weaver goes in the hypersleep tube. Hicks is in one. Sigourney's the last one to go in. And again, she has very unfortunate underwear that I don't understand why she can't just wear something a little more, I don't know, comfortable or something. But
maybe that's what she finds comfortable.
Perhaps. I am judging, I suppose. She gets in and there's the hypersleep music and then, you know, credits. Ta-da.
Yeah, you can dream now.
Yeah, because definitely nothing bad is still lingering on board the ship.
As far as we're aware.
Yes.
I don't remember from Alien 3. Do they bother to explain where, how, why, what happened?
Yeah, apparently the alien queen had left eggs inside of the ship, dropship, which hatch while they're in hypersleep, and then somehow...
How did it have eggs? It lost its thing.
Yeah, I don't know. And then it breaks into the things, and Sigourney Weaver gets impregnated in her sleep with an alien queen embryo, and then the other facehugger, I think, hangs out until there's the dog thing when they crash, and then that facehugger implants that dog thing, and then you get the sort of dog-like alien creature that's inside of Alien 3.
I don't remember enough of that one.
Well, you'll remember it next year.
Well, I remember the alien. I don't remember it being dog-like, I guess.
Well, it was a quadruped puppet thing.
It's not a good movie.
No, it's not.
It's a good concept, though. If you want to, like, how do you take the next step in something like this where you've advanced the story and you can't do the same thing a third time? Like, where do you go from there? Like, I like the initial idea of where they were going to take Alien 3. It is just horrible to try and watch that movie.
I don't like the initial idea of where they're trying to take Alien 3 because it requires jettisoning everything we liked about this.
I mean, it didn't have to jettison everything we like about this, but, you know, what do you do with the characters once you've done this same thing ostensibly twice? A lot of people choose to end trilogies in a dramatic fashion like this as well, so...
Yeah.
If the trilogy was intended to be the end, if the third was intended to be the end, which I think that's what they were trying to do before they decided they had to make some money back on the franchise because they lost a bunch on the third one, it would have been a way to end it and, you know, potentially resolve it in a good way. But it's a well-documented cluster.
Yeah. The making of on it that's on YouTube is amazing. Because there are so many things that are even worse that never made it to screen. Like the whole wooden planet full of monks. That I just don't even... I can't comprehend it. Anyway, go seek that out. There is, of course, some things that I actually like about Alien Resurrection. And one of them, I feel, would have been a better continuation for Alien 3, which is the start of Alien Resurrection, where they find basically... human alien material to do experiments on and to try to control and to show the ways in which they can't control it, which I feel like that movie does well and then completely goes off the rails. So it has moments.
You say you don't like Sigourney's basketball skills?
I think it's amazing that she actually got that shot, even though it wasn't framed for it. Mm-hmm. Apparently, they didn't think she'd get it, and then she just happened to. And they were just like, "Wow, we can't believe it." But we didn't have it framed like that. We had it framed so it would go out of frame and then go back in with the other thing. So they misjudged her abilities, I suppose. But
the only other thing I remember about that movie is I think Winona Ryder has like a 3.5 millimeter jack on her arm or something to connect to the computer.
No, not 3.5. It's the big.
It's the quarter inch jack.
Yeah, it's the big stereo one. Because they ripped out their modems. Anyway, spoiling a movie we're going to talk about in 2 years.
Yeah. I don't know if I can commit to that long.
You're gonna. You see this thing through to the end. Full quadrilogy plus Prometheus.
Are we skipping the Alien versus Predators?
Oh, no, we're doing those too.
Oh, God, they're so bad. What about Predators, plural? Predator, Predator 2, Predators.
Wait, what?
There was a movie called Predators. That was the one with Adrian Brody in it?
Totally lost on this one.
It came out, I don't know what, like 5 years ago?
We're going to have to investigate this later because I don't think I've ever heard of this. Are you sure it's not just...
Predators, 2010, Adrian Brody, Lawrence Fishburne.
Mm.
This was directed by... I don't know who this is.
It's not Paul W.S. Anderson again.
No.
They were like, oh, we made a horrible mistake. Let's stop doing that.
I'm going to assume his name is pronounced Nimrod, but it's written as Nimrod.
Oh.
Antal.
Antal Nimrod?
No, Nimrod Antal.
Oh.
I don't know how to pronounce it.
Okay, we'll just call him Antal.
He directed a Metallica documentary.
Mm, dear.
A movie called Vacancy.
Well, we'll have to slot this one in.
No, I've seen it. It's a very bad movie.
But I just said we have to slot this one in. You got to take the good and the bad. You can't just like select things.
I mean, it can. We can. It's our show. We don't have to talk about bad things.
I need it. I need my pain.
Okay.
I think we're done.
I think we're done. Aliens is a good movie.
Yep. Go watch Aliens.
I bought it on iTunes. It's good.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of special features are on there.
I bought the quadrilogy because I was like, you know what? The odds of us talking about the rest of these are exceptionally high since I'm insisting on it. So I should probably buy the whole thing.
I don't know that I have the energy to watch all of three.
You're doing it. And you're going to love it.
It's so bad, though. Like, I hate the aesthetic of Alien 3 more than anything, I think.
The design of that planet is unpleasant. Apparently, that is something that they were already married to before the production even started, because that was something that had been put in place by the previous director with the previous story.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the influences over the story and the direction they were going with this one. Is like, hey, we started building stuff because we couldn't just keep all these people waiting around.
Yeah, I love that part of the documentary where Fincher's like, all right, let's walk around these sets that you've already built and see where we can find some shots.
Yeah.
Move Up says just watch the Alien vs. Predator movies. I tried to watch the beginning, I think, of Alien vs. Predator, the first one, I don't know, a month or two ago or whatever. And it's just like, it's like they tried their hardest to write a really bad movie. And yeah, it's
like they had... fan fiction writing, but enough money to hire Lance Henriksen and to do some really competent character effects work. And I'm being absolutely serious. I'm not joking. I think that the creature effects that they did for the aliens and the predators in that are very good. I'm not joking at all. Not even a little bit. Especially the Alien Queen, they revisit it and do a pretty good job. It's a giant puppet thing again. So, you know, could be worse. But
The story and the acting is not good.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, there's the rest of the film, which is something I wouldn't say about, you know, a film like Aliens, where it's like, oh, yeah, the rest of the film is good. That's a reason to watch it, in spite of the 80s-ness of some of the effects.
Yeah.
All right, so We're done here.
Nuke it from orbit.
Yeah, it's the only way to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? Was it like a hymn?
Yeah, I was just agreeing with you in a very musical fashion.